Blaine?
My man.
Hey, man, it's Chris.
Chris Breezy, what's up, dude? How are you?
Pretty good, you know? Pretty good for a Wednesday.
Ooh. Are you living your dad life?
Yeah, dad life strong. How about you?
I'm good, man. We're good, yeah. Little man's happy and healthy, waking up to the world. He's starting to smile, so, you know, he's all grown up.
Yeah.
Day by day.
Yeah, same over here. It's nice that they were born within the same week. You know, we're hitting those development strides together.
Mm-hmm. It's like it's a partnership we're developing here.
Hey, man, well, I was giving you a call. I wanted to see what you're thinking about rerunning, like an episode of Two People.
Ooh. I remember that show. It's so good. I enjoyed doing it. It's been a little while. Yeah. What do you think about Craig Dodson?
I love Craig Dodson.
My man. Yeah. Yeah, he's one of those ones that I think about. Great storyteller, super passionate. And I think with like a lot of stuff going on in Mosby, he's somehow been able to gain trust through the work that he does with Richmond Cycle Corps.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, since we've recorded, he's now a big-time dude, featured on that scene in Heroes.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you feel about that, Chris Payne?
I say we do it.
Word. All right. Then it is agreed.
Cool.
It is agreed between us.
Okay. Well, this might also be our intro, so you want to kick into some No BS Brass?
Yeah. Oh, is that like a duet we should do?
Yeah, let's try it.
Okay. Who starts?
I don't know.
Hey there. I'm Blaine Lay. You're listening to Two People. It's a podcast about Richmond. Each episode, of course, we talk to the two people behind somebody's story, so their personal side and their public side. We talk about their experiences and how that comes to life in the work that they do, whatever that work may be. Today we've got Craig Dodson from Richmond Cycling Corps. Craig and his team train with kids from some tough neighborhoods in Richmond, teaching them how to ride bikes competitively and passing on some life lessons along the way. Craig talks about the ways that his family and his father in particular shaped him and how he got into high-level competitive cycling at an early age. Craig also talks about the story of the first time he stumbled into Creighton Court and how Richmond Cycling Corps began. Craig is a gritty dude. He actually lives on a boat and has a bunch of old vehicles, which he talks about early in our interview. One quick note, there are one or two minor instances of some colorful language in this episode, so if you have children around and you don't want them to hear that, this is just your heads up. Not a major thing, just wanted to let you know. So stay tuned, this is episode 14 with Craig Dodson. You're listening to Two People. So Craig Dodson, welcome to the show, man. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good. We're sitting here in my living room. Appreciate you making the time today. I wanted to start and ask just about all of your vehicles. Can you tell me about the different vehicles that you have in your life before we dig in?
They're old. So I've got a 77 Honda Goldwing.
Is that the boat?
That is not. I should name the boat the Goldwing. No, it's a motorcycle.
Okay.
So it's cool. It's a cool old vintage bike. I've got an 89 Jeep Wagoneer. And I've got a 73 Chris Craft boat that I live on. And they're all just, they're old, pain in the ass. They all have carburetors, so I can't get them all working at the same time.
Right.
But you know, that's, yeah, they're cool. When they work, they're cool.
And your boat's down near Rockets, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Cool. Very quickly, Richmond Cycling Corps, who are you? What do you guys do?
Well, it's a hybrid model. So we take programming. Our outlet is cycling. And we merge that with a high detailed case management, behavioral reengineering. predominantly for youth and public housing. And we have, you know, started with, you know, it was sort of a pilot. Let's see if this would work. By the second year, kids were going on to ride 100 miles in a day. Kids continued to hit that milestone. Then we started a mountain bike team out of Armstrong High School. So the nation's first and only inner city high school cycling team.
And you built a mountain biking course there, right?
And then we went and built a mountain bike park at the high school. So it's literally there's a 1 mile mountain bike park on a piece of vacant land in the middle of public housing. Built that, and then we started the nation's first and only middle school inner city cycling team at MLK Middle. So that's what we do, and then we wrap that into to case management.
Okay, so it's the cycling and the case management piece.
It has to be, and we literally lure kids in. No kid's going to sign up for something called case management, right? So you lure them in with something that, you know, is an attractive thing that they'd want to do, and then you leverage that to continue to produce the behavioral results that you want.
So essentially, you have a structure of training that you're inviting these kids into training with you. And now how often do you guys have races?
We race about 10 to 15 times a year.
Okay.
And so, but they're very, it's the high school league, which is very, you know, prestigious league. I mean, these kids are, you know, some of these kids have gone on to get professional contracts at racing this league. So, it's not a novelty. I mean, it's real training. You know, our kids are really good. They're very fast. But it's taking years to get to that point. Right. It wasn't like we just did that overnight. I mean, most of my kids have been with me 4 or 5 years.
Right. And one of them beat you recently, didn't they? Didn't you say, I read something where you said it was the first time. And I don't know if that's because the kids are that good or because your
kids are that good.
Or because your body is decaying.
Well, yeah. I am. It's probably a function of both. The kids are developing. They're just getting really good. And, you know, I don't ride as much anymore. And they're getting fitter and stronger. And there's sort of a delta, man. There's sort of this this overlap. And a few weeks ago, I got legitimately dropped by one of our kids up Libby Hill towards the end of a workout. He just kind of attacked me. And
Pulling away from you.
I tried to go with him. And the daylight just kept opening up between us. And it was probably one of the best moments of my life.
Cool. So I want to ask a little bit about just your story, you know, because you grew up in Maryland, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about growing up, just your parents, what were you interested in as a kid, how'd you get into cycling?
I mean, right. I grew up really total suburban neighborhood outside of Annapolis, between Baltimore and Annapolis, and curb-sided streets, cul-de-sacs. It was as middle class as what middle class was back then. And we were in the neighborhood. I'd say our family was definitely more on the lower end of that. And, you know, my parents got us into that neighborhood and were able to keep us there. And, you know, we had what we needed, but we were definitely, you know, as we've gotten older and you look back, we didn't quite have what the other kids had, but it was a good neighborhood, good schools, good, you know, all that stuff. And that's where I grew up, and I had good parents, man. You know, my parents got split up when I was like 12, and my older brother is 2 years older, sort of ended up going with my mom, and I ended up staying with my dad.
Okay.
And you know, my mom actually just now has finished her college degree.
Oh, cool.
She went back just a couple years ago and got it, and she's now getting her master's. My father, he never finished 10th grade in high school, and he was this guy that he grew up in a real rough and tumble neighborhood in Baltimore. He was a very scrappy guy and learned really sort of fight his way out of a lot of problems. And he was, my dad's 6'1", probably growing up, he was about 140 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
But he was kind of a guy that dudes didn't really mess with,
right?
In the neighborhood. And that's, it's pretty verified by my uncle, his younger brother. Just basically like, yeah, your dad was a badass. And he was this guy that was, I think my penchant for old vehicles that are a never ending mound of work, comes from my dad. I mean, I think he was 13 when he started driving. And he was 14, I think, when he got his first car and started working on it, and pretty much figured out that he was very mechanically inclined, and that he sort of ran with that. I think he started as a bus driver at 19, 20 years old.
Wow.
And was a Baltimore City bus driver for pretty much his entire life.
Okay.
And so he, he was there for the riots with MLK. And he's seen a lot, driving a bus in Baltimore. And he just was one of those guys that I always saw getting up every day, going to work. He had to be incredibly on time. He had this mm-hmm. watch. He had this sort of pocket watch. It had to have so many jewels in it to keep such an accurate time. I remember that was a pocket watch. And, just seeing him in the mornings growing up, literally rushing out the door, tying a Windsor knot, getting into some old junker car that he had. He never paid more than $500 for a car. That was like his thing.
Right.
And they were old, old Pontiacs. He had old Cougar, VW, old Bugs, anything he could piece together, he drove. And but just seeing him, pouring cereal into a big gulp cup, tying a knot, grabbing his pocket watch, jumping into an old car and flying to work. I mean, that to me is one of the truest senses of a role model. Hmm. Because there's a guy he's doing it. He's doing it for, he's doing it for me. He's doing it for the mortgage. He's doing it to, because it needs to get done.
Right.
And it wasn't an academic thing, I wasn't a great student at all. Like, I was a really shitty student. Like, really just shitty. Academics just weren't my interest, and by default, they weren't my strong suit. Yeah. So
what were you into? Like, in your form middle school, high school, how'd you get into cycling? Was that one thing of many, or was that a passion that came out?
Not really. I got into bikes because I found I was just better than my peers at riding. A lot of the kids in the neighborhood, I think, where are we? Like late 80s, early 90s, mid 90s. Everyone was trying to be Tony Hawk. And, I ended up on a bike on the same skate ramps that they were using. And I found out that for some reason I was able to throw that bike around. It just felt really natural. And so I just sort of claimed that, I think at that age I was looking for an identity. Right. I mean, a lot of kids are, not to get all, wonder years on it, but it was one of those things that I wasn't really, I was a good athlete. Like I was good. I was naturally athletic. And so, I played basketball and played baseball and lacrosse and soccer. And, my mom signed us up in these leagues and I always did pretty well. But when I got on the bike, I was sort of heads and shoulders above other kids that were doing it from the BMX standpoint. And so I ran with that and I owned it. I was a kid that was wearing my BMX jersey to school and, reading my BMX rags and, drawing all over my notebooks.
Right.
And knew the movie Rad, every word. My friend stopped watching it with me because I was so annoying, because I just could do that. I was like that kind of guy, and posters all over my wall, and it became something that I owned and something that I was actually proud about. And so that was sort of, I just latched onto that and held on, and that just sort of kept pulling me. It's navigated every direction of my life since I was 10, 11 years old.
Right. And you would still, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you went to community college for a little while. You went to Shepherd in West Virginia, and you did a stint in grad school. How did, there was like the academic side of your life, but also the cycling, and you eventually came here and had a cycling team here in Richmond.
Yeah, it was all just bike. It was all bike. Like, after high school, there was just no plan. I didn't have really anything. And so I did what a lot of kids did was kind of 13th grade and just went to community college and stayed home and tried to figure my shit out and what I was going to do. So after my first year of community college, you know, I was in this environment where it was a little bit more, you had assignments, but you were lectured to, not at, sort of thing. And I kind of enjoyed that.
Right.
And started having more free rein on the papers that I wrote and started turning in good papers and getting good grades on those. And so then I started thinking, wow, I'm not entirely stupid.
which is a good realization.
Which is a good revelation. You know, I remember that day. I think I probably, you know, bought myself a Slurpee and celebrated the fact that I wasn't entirely stupid.
Celebratory Slurpee.
Yeah. And so, you know, did the community college thing, kept racing bikes and moved up to expert category and just was like, this is it. This is what I want to do. Found what was then Shepherd College. It's now Shepherd University. But I found it because I went out there to do some riding with a friend of mine.
This is in West Virginia.
This is right in the Panhandle. So it's on the Maryland border, West Virginia, Virginia. They all sort of come together in that spot near Harpers Ferry.
Okay.
So I'd gone out there to do some riding and stumbled. This will be the theme here. Stumbled across the school and I was like, yellow brick, really cool campus, very liberal arts sort of institution. I thought, hey, you know, I could do this. Looked into it. I had the GPA, I had the requirements, and applied. I got in, and that was it. I packed up. I had my first car. And through college, I drove a 1974 Ford van.
Ford van.
I mean, nothing says creepy like a high school senior driving a van with homemade curtains in the back. I'll never forget my prom dates. Her dad's look when I came roaring into the driveway with that. He sort of said, "What's up with the curtains?" And I was like, hey, I made those myself. Pretty cool, huh? And he was just like, have her back by 11. It's ridiculous. So I pack up my van and I head off to Shepherd. And my dad slips me $20. He says, make it last. And that was it. So I moved into my dorm and went to Shepherd and rode bikes. And
didn't you have I remember you telling me about a fairly Spartan apartment that you
so
had.
That was... So later. Yeah. So that's my last, my first 2 years I was living dorm life. My last 2 years I, went back out and, all the dorms were full and, I sort of lost my spot in line and, I ended up living in this, sort of 8x12 shack garage, you know, with no running water, and just had a wood burning stove and an outhouse. And,
did you enjoy that?
I did. You know, those were probably some of the best 2 years of my life. I mean, it was right on the river, of the Potomac River, and it was cold and it was sort of lonely. And it was, found that I fed off of that. I don't know why. It was the first time in my life I really, and I didn't even know what I was feeling, but I sort of discovered, hey, you know, I'm an introvert. I enjoy this a lot. I enjoy this seclusion.
Right.
Those are two really fun years. And I learned a lot. You know, I had to sort of make this shack a place to live. And, you know, I learned a lot about how important properly grounded wires are on a refrigerator and, you know, things like, you know, just you had to be incredibly creative.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking 3 a.m. in the middle of winter with no heat in a center block metal roof, you know, shed basically.
Right.
You know, you really have to improvise to just get through the night. And then I was taking showers at the gym and I had this 5-gallon water container that I would take. I would take it once a week into the gym and fill it up at the shower. So I'd be taking a shower in the gym and I'd be holding this thing to the other shower head. And, you know, people were walking in and just seeing this 6'3" naked guy holding a 5-gallon jug to the shower. And, you know, it was just like, nothing to see here. Just keep
going. Where does that come from? Because I'm at this point, I'm hearing a theme that there's, I think there's an introversion piece, but a part of me is like, are you just a glutton for punishment? That there's a more comfortable way of life that you could have.
Yeah, I don't know. So, you know, you actually, you know, that night we sort of rapped, you know, you sort of made this, this parallel with my choice to live on the boat or my choice to, you know, have these things or not. You know, I could go get the Honda Civic.
Right.
And then just put the key in, it starts every time. And I don't know, you know, subconsciously I was probably seeing my dad, man. You know, I mean, I remember seeing my dad, just everything looked more difficult than it had to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember the entire dash of, he had this, I think it was a 77, 78 Mercury Cougar, really cool car. The whole dash came out. I mean, this thing was one of those $500 clunkers that he bought, and the whole, it just dropped. It was made out of this really chalky plastic that they were using back then. And I saw him pull the entire dash out, all the instruments, take it all into the kitchen with a hot glue gun and glue this entire thing up. Nothing was wired back, but it just, I mean, this took an entire weekend. And I remember he set all the dials so that he always had a full tank of gas. It always was, you know, the temperature was always perfect. He just set all the dials perfect where they needed to be.
Right.
But nothing worked.
So you are your father's son that way.
Yeah. Well, of course the hot glue melted after it got hot. And it just sort of coming apart. But, you know, I saw him do it with the lawnmower, the chainsaw, anytime he built something, he always did great work, but he always did it the hard way. He always did it his way.
Right.
And somewhere along the lines, there would be these sort of moments of self-discovery for him, I think, and he fed off of that. And in that way, he was brilliant, right? So you're talking about a guy that never finished 10th grade, but in my opinion, my dad's, you know, one of the smartest people I've ever met. Yeah, I think I picked up on a lot of that, and I think doing things the harder way sort of motivates me. In a way. Yeah.
So I want to jump to you moving to Richmond and start talking a little bit about the cycling team. So you moved here in 2005.
Yep.
And before you started Richmond Cycle Corps, you had a cycling team here, right? How did that come about?
So, you know, when I finished up at Shepherd, I pretty much went as full-time as I could go with racing bikes. So in 2004... in the winter of 2003, actually, I left and I had an old Subaru station wagon. I packed it up and I drove to a little town called Silver City, New Mexico. And the town sits at 6,000 feet. You can climb up to, I think pretty close to like 11,000 feet. So the premise was to get out at altitude and train at altitude. And I had an opportunity to train with a guy that was, you know, sort of at the top of his game and one of the top cyclists. Actually, he got fourth in the world championships in the time trial.
Oh, wow.
So he was, you know, he knew what was up. And, so I head out there and I found, again, discovered there was a school there. And, and it was just this little university in this town of about 10,000 people. And I went to the school one day and just inquired. They had a human performance program. And I talked to the head of that. And
what does that mean, human performance? Is that like physical?
Yeah, it's exercise phys. So okay. My undergrad was exercise science.
Gotcha.
So you know, it was basically like an exercise phys program. And this guy who was running the program said, I don't have any grad students right now, but I would not be opposed to having one. And it would be more around movement science, which is biomechanics. And I said, that sounds great. Let me get back to you.
Right. You're a guy that moves.
I'm a guy that moves. And you know, the science of that sounds cool. So that was that. Didn't think much of it, really. Went to Florida to get a contract for a racing team. Got it. Stayed with them for the year. And then at the end of 2004, basically had an opportunity to start my own team. and I was 20, I think it was 25 years old at that point. And so I was trying to continue racing, start my own team, and start grad school. So I'd contact and made a deal with the advisor that I would start school there in January of 2005. And I went to New Mexico, put this 4-man hit squad together. And it was myself, guy from New Hampshire, guy from New York, and a South American. And we needed a place to centralize the team. I knew about Richmond. There was a pro race here in town. And so it's called the Cap Tech Classic. And so I'd been to Richmond. And one of the higher ups for the company that was sponsoring us.
Who was that?
It was this guy Chip.
Or what was the company?
The company was Nature's Path.
Okay.
And he had actually helped us broker the funding for the team. And so I thought, you know, this guy seems really cool. Let's get closer to him and centralize the team. They had an international airport and it was on 95. So we did. So we found a small team house over in the north side area. And that was it, man. We got to Richmond and had our team house. We were here a few days during the week and then we get back and travel again and race and started to kind of like the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I would drive back across to New Mexico and spend a couple months there and then drive back to Richmond. I did that for about 2 years.
And so Richmond was kind of home base for the team and for you, but you guys were out and about.
Yeah, Richmond became home base after the first year. It just felt right. We weren't here that much though.
Right.
We were traveling all over the country, so we weren't really, we honestly didn't know the city that well. That's how it happened.
Right. So can you tell me the story of how Richmond Cycling Corps began? What was the genesis of that for you?
Yeah.
Like you moved to Richmond, you're racing, you've got this team, and then fast forward, 4 or 5 years, and you're now running this program with kids in the city. How did that transition happen?
Yeah. So 2005, I just got into Richmond, and we'd only been here, I think, 2 weeks. 2-3 weeks. We weren't here long and we didn't know the city at all. We didn't know where downtown was. I think we'd been to Carytown once. We didn't know where that was in relation to the city, and we didn't know what a Shaco was. We didn't, you know, none of this did we know. And the race was coming up, the Cap Tech Classic, and Tim Miller, who was the guy behind the World Championships, was also doing this race, was also the guy in spearheading the Cap Tech Classic, which was a downtown crit, which was kind of what our team was. We were more of a Criterium team that, you know, would sort of do these races, and it was sort of a traveling circus all around the country to do these races. So we reached out to Tim, and he said, well, I'm having all the teams who are in town, and by default, you guys are in town, do these school visits, sort of the few days leading up to the race. And we thought, great, we'll count us in. You know, where do you need us to go? And he put us, he said, well, I'm going to put you at this rec center in this neighborhood, Creighton Court. And, you know, I didn't know where Creighton Court was or what it was, or just sounded like actually a pretty decent neighborhood to me.
Right.
And so we packed up the team car, and myself, my teammate from New Hampshire, you know, we got in and we got our team polos and khaki pants and $4,000 bikes on the roof, and we go flying down 64. We get on the 9 Mile Road exit. And he's got this really crude GPS and sort of like, this can't be right. It's like, no, this is right. Make a right turn right here. And we go into the heart of Creighton Court, and we didn't know that this part of Richmond existed. You could feel that it was out of sight, out of mind. So we pull into Creighton Court, and we get out, and there's this little rec center, and we pull the bikes off the car, and we like triple lock the car, you know, just to make sure. And we run into this rec center, and there's like 30 kids from Creighton Court sitting there for us to present to. And the dude that was sort of running the rec center was like, hey, which one of you guys is who's gonna do this? My teammate sort of takes a step back. It leaves me by default to talk to these kids. And so I get up there and I'm basically giving them the same crap that they've heard, you know, that if they don't do drugs, if you stay in school, if you work real hard, you can be like me, you know, you can be this semi-pro bike racer with a $4,000 bike and a polo shirt and khaki pants and a minivan with a bunch of logos all over it.
Right.
And the looks on their face, the looks on their faces were just, it was just such a, like, I was a joke. It was a joke. What I was saying was a joke, and there was no connection. Hmm. And almost, you know, as if we hadn't heard this before. And you can tell us this all we want, but like, look around. Our reality is what you see. And it was horrible. It was about a 20 minute jam. And we left out of there. My teammate thought, hey, you crushed it in there. Wow, it was really good. And I was like, dude, are you kidding me, man? Did you like not feel what they were giving off was, yeah, just, you know, we're fools. We're fools, and they didn't want to hear it because they don't believe it. And it sucked. It was a horrible feeling that I had in my stomach.
And did that sit with you for a while?
Sat with me for 5 years. Hmm. 5 years. I would just think about it. You know, when you're a cyclist and you're out there and you're training a lot, you're on these, you know, 4 or 5 hour rides and sort of just, you're by yourself. Your mind goes to so many pockets. Hmm. It's really, every corner's Pandora's box. And so there were so many times just literally riding through the desert of New Mexico, right? Because that was 2005. You know, I'm going back out there to train and stuff. Right. And where I'm thinking about this and sort of tormenting myself about it. I mean, and years had gone by at some points, and it was just still one of those things that was very sharp and very, felt like an ulcer, and I didn't like it. So 2010, you know, pretty much when I stopped playing bike racer,
right.
I decided, hey, let me just try. I didn't expect it to really become anything. I just wanted to, it was self-serving, to be honest. I wanted to go back and sort of try and fix something that I'd felt 5 years earlier.
Hmm.
And that's, you know, it's almost narcissistic, really.
Right.
And that year was able to get four kids from Fairfield Court to do 50 miles in a day in a torrential downpour up in Philadelphia at this event. And, sort of finished that and was like, damn, that just happened. And you know, we've only been doing this 8 months. I think there's something here. And that was it.
Yeah.
And it just exploded after that.
So that was 5 years ago.
That was 2010.
So now 5 years later, can you just paint a picture of some of the things that you're dealing with inside of the organization that you're not, my sense is you're not just sitting behind a desk and running a program. And you talk a lot about case management and really being immersed in the lives of these kids with them. Can you just paint the picture of what your work looks like?
I mean, so ignorance is bliss with a lot of this. And because I'm my own, and just being naive to the nonprofit world and how things run and how outreach should be done. So I didn't read, nor did I really listen to the experts. I just sort of did what seemingly had to be done. So early on, I found that putting kids on bikes or putting poor black kids on bikes isn't enough. That's just a novelty, mm-hmm. really. That's not doing anything. And what the real gaps are is, you know, the gaps are not trying to get these kids to be professional cyclists. The gaps are, there is a variables of behavior that are prevalent with these kids that are in this concentrated poverty, as concentrated as you can get and as impoverished as you can get. Fourth generation, some fifth generation, what's happening in terms of fundamentals of how to get out of public housing, which are the fundamentals that I saw with my dad, which were accountability, responsibility, hard work, grit. You know, these things were totally absent in the engineering of these kids. And so,
because I think in your case, you had someone that you could learn, you know, the putting the cereal in the cup and
yeah. Work. Yeah. So why was my dad putting cereal in the cup? My dad was putting cereal in the cup because he didn't have time to eat the breakfast because he had to rush to work because he had to be at a certain time. And if he wasn't there at a certain time,
right,
he lost his job. And if he lost his job, he didn't have income. If he didn't have income, he didn't have a mortgage. Right. We didn't have a place to live. I didn't have my $40 Vans. It wasn't happening.
Right.
So you know, even at that age, at 12, 13, 14 years old, I was able to connect the dots of like A plus B equals C, but that simple formula is just not, it's absent for these kids.
So how do you go about connecting the dots for them or even working with the other dots that are being connected?
So the number one thing you're dealing with predominantly is reactionary behavior, right? So you've got this reactionary, these are my norms. This is how I understand the world. And this is how I react to the world. It's not how I think. My reaction is to be, you know, jump the gun on things.
Right.
And so, you know, you look at that and everything sort of spawns from that sort of nucleus. Like, okay, so how do we slow it down? How do we mitigate reactionary behavior? And you know, you just attack it sort of head on. You just go right at it, and you try to get them, the kids, to slow everything down. There's no real simple answer to that because every kid is so different. You know, some kids you can be a little tougher on. Some kids, you know, you have to be a little bit more gentle, you know, to get the message across. So it's so different. But at the end of the day, the first thing you do is you hold them accountable for everything. Like, you don't let them slip on that. And you hold yourself accountable too. You know, I mean, to do this work, you have to go above and beyond just from 9 to 5.
I mean, you're on call, you know, all 24/7. Hours, right?
24/7. You're on call 24/7. Middle of the night. Their environment doesn't stop.
Right.
You know, it's not like there's a punch card, like you wake up in public housing and you're just like, well, I'm going to punch in for the day and then I'm going to punch out and everything's cool. It's like, no, it's whipped up all the time.
Right.
So.
Because you're in the homes, on the streets, rides, meals, everything. Like you name it. You
got to be there. You got to be there.
Their lives, right.
Yeah. You know.
Well, it's interesting too, because I think you are very unique in terms of your approach to this work. And I do think it's a part of, you know, the Shepherd College, West Virginia, this apartment and doing the water. Like there's a grit and like a tenacity that is really unique. And I don't think that a lot of people could approach the work the way that you do. And I think in a lot of ways, that's what makes it so effective. And I think there's a question when people talk about, oh, Richmond Cycling Corps, it's remarkable. It's amazing. They're in here. Let's scale this. But I think there's a tension because the way that you go about it personally, Craig, it's hard to scale that level of intimacy, commitment, and being on call around the clock, right?
Yeah, this is not a career. You know, that's the first thing is, you know, this isn't really a job for me. Do I make a living? Yeah, but it's, I don't know, man. At the end of the day, and I tell the kids this too, I think a lot of folks sort of operate as if, I don't know, they're going to live forever or something. Like this, let's just have a lot of meetings and let's,
right.
What's the action plan? What's the action plan for the action plan? Let's talk about it first. Let's talk. How much red tape can we get tangled in? The more the better. You know,
And you're like, you're the opposite.
I'm the opposite, man. Every time I drive by a graveyard, seriously, when I drive by a graveyard and I look at a tombstone and I look at that, and I go, that person, whoever that person was, they were born at a certain time. They had a certain moment where they were here, and now they're obviously not, because I can see that. What I wonder what they did, or I wonder if they wish they could get that do-over. I wonder, you know, and it just, for me, like, I can't do that. Like, right. For me, it's like I'm scrambling. I'm fighting time,
mm-hmm.
because there's so much that I want to get done in such little time that there's no, I've been like that since I was a kid, you know, like I've always been like that. It's just been this, like, it's not that I rush things, but I rush things. Like, right. I want to get things done.
I mean, I think that's really interesting. You talk about there's a finiteness to a time we have on Earth, but what I'm hearing is you don't want to waste that, right?
I don't want to waste it. I don't want to waste my kids' time.
Yeah. Not just for you, but for them.
For them, man. Yeah. I mean, like, that environment is, it's a total double-edged sword, because you have kids that are growing up way too fast, but mentally, or being able to, like, sort of comprehend things are way behind.
Right.
So you have kids doing these things that, you know, or seeing these things, or being in an environment that would be hard for a 30-year-old to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
But they're like in it and they're doing it.
Right.
So it's not that they're only in it, but they're like participating.
Right.
And so their environment is moving so fast, but their personal development is going the other way. Like, right. So they're going in opposite directions. So you've got so much work to do. You've got so much to get done in really such a short amount of time,
mm-hmm.
that you don't have time to sit around and analyze every little move and every little decision.
Right.
You just have to, feel like you've got good instincts and you're going to just run with that. And that's, there it is right there. And that's why it's hard to scale.
Right. There was a big event the Friday night before the bike race, yeah. where you laid out the vision for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about your plan and your goal?
I mean, in a nutshell, you know, the goal is to have one of the kids that's come through our program take my job. And that's big, and it's big, and it's lofty and it's heavy.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people would sit back and say, well, what do they know? You know, how are they going to run a nonprofit? What, you know, there's so much to it. Man, I'm not asking them to do fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not asking them to do public speaking. I'm not asking them to navigate the board. The talent is that interface that with those kids. And if a 36-year-old dude that looks like me can do it pretty damn well, like, imagine how well those kids could do it that have come from those neighborhoods, dealt with those struggles, and then can basically flip that around and do the work that I'm doing. And if I'm teaching them the right way, I mean, look, at the end of the day, if that can't happen after 10 years, if after 10 years, I can't get one of the kids in our program to do my job at that level, being the interface in that community, I failed. That's a failure to me.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in just milking this along to run a business.
Yeah. And it's really interesting, because I was talking to a friend of mine. She's a person of color, and she said, hey, you know, athletics are great, but we need more people from these communities to be molded into the leaders.
Correct.
Because they have the resources and the ability to do that. And I think along with that, and I think it's a fair point that there's I think, and rightfully so, a reason to be suspect of sort of like the white savior complex, where you have people moving in and saying, I'm great, I'm going to do these great things, rather than, and so when I heard that, you were saying, you are saying essentially, I'm trying to figure out how I can work myself out of a job because they have the resources here in this place to do this.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa.
You have to. Look, man, at the end of the day, it's a drop in the bucket, really, what organizations are able to do, especially in public housing. If things are only working at a fraction of, if they're only as effective at a fraction of what they could be, you got to get in there and shake up the snow globe, man. You've got to try something different. If for no other reason than to try something different. I don't run this program. Hmm. The kids have been running it for 5 years. It's not mine. Like, I don't dictate what we do. The kids do.
So usually you're responding to the needs that they're.
I'm responding to basically mostly nonverbal cues that they're giving, whether this is working or not. The number one is, are they engaged? Are they still coming back?
Right.
If you're losing kids, your core kids, and that's the thing, you kind of have to have a core. If you're losing them, you're doing something wrong. You're not evolving with them, or you're not evolving as fast as the environment in which they're in, you know? So if it's, you know, peers that are pulling them out, if it's drugs, if it's a lack of interest, if it's a been there, done that, and you're not evolving to keep up with them, then, you know, you're fooling yourself. It's like, it's their program. They've been running it. You need to work around them. Don't necessarily let them know that, in the sense that, like, you guys get to call the shots, or every day they'd be like, we're taking a bus trip to King's Dominion. Well, that's not really what we do. Right. But, you know, it's just this sort of trying to be more like an amoeba and changing mm-hmm. your shape and just sort of work. Set some boundaries, set some parameters, but be incredibly flexible all the time. Like, and shape-shifting. Pick a direction, use a compass, don't use a map, and figure out how to get north. You might have to go east-west 50 times, you might have to go south a couple times, but eventually just pick the direction due north and get there. And, you know, that's where I've been very fortunate with my board, and people around me have just said, go do your thing, don't get stuck in the quagmire, you know, use your instincts, and keep making, like, things are going in the trajectory that you want. Keep going, keep going, keep going. Yeah. And I mean, pivot as you need.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, the way that you articulate that is that there's almost a startup mentality to it. I think the way that you approach your work, that a larger
total startup
institution, yeah. Like, my head first goes to, I don't know, you think about education in Richmond, but I think the benefit that you have is being on the ground, knowing these kids, looking them in the eye, knowing what they're engaged in, what works, what doesn't, that if you're, I don't know, sitting in an office trying to design a program for the entire city, that I think you can miss the world that you're living in, you know, perhaps the thing that you're designing for and the people that you're designing for. I just think there's a beauty and a level of understanding that you have because you're able to empathize and understand their world in a way that others might not. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, when you're on the ground like that, you see it. It's being in the trenches.
Right.
And, you know, you see it, you know, like, there's very smart people saying and directing things in a very smart way. But, you know, if you're fighting, if you're in a war and you're those guys in the trenches and you're looking at who you're fighting or what you're fighting, and you can see what ammunition they're using, what weapons they're using, you know.
You know it on a tactical.
You know it on a tactical sense. Like, yeah, you're looking at it. You can see it. That's the guys you want coming back to report to you, saying, "All right, Commander, they're using this. They're using this military tactic. Do take this information, use it. I'm going back out there." Yeah, I mean, I think, going back to that sort of being entrepreneurial, right? So that's all I know. That's all I know is how to do that.
Right.
And I've said it many, many times. I am not a good CEO. I'm just not. I'm a startup guy. And I'm a guy that can get something off the ground, and it's going to be a lot of turbulence, and you're going to have the seatbelt on, and the no smoking sign, and the put the trays back up, and seats got to go back up. And I'll get it off the ground, but I'm not the guy that's going to get it at cruising altitude.
Yeah,
someone else can do that. And right now we're still in startup mode.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, one of the things that I've definitely learned, it's within the scope of the nonprofit sector, but so often our organizations not looking at their outreach as a product. And you know, the best analogy I can use, again, goes back to Apple. I look at Apple and I look at the fact that every 6 months, every year, they put a new gadget on their phone. You know, the screen's bigger, it swipes differently. You know, it's got some new function to the phone,
right,
that people stand in line for 12 hours and wait for this new phone. So Apple's figured out that they can get this demand out of consumers for their products, and it keeps them excited. It keeps them, there's buy-in,
mm-hmm,
there's retention.
So you're trying to think about how do you translate that into
the same thing in outreach, right? It's the same thing in outreach. Like, you have to constantly come up with a fresh product.
When you say outreach, you're saying drawing students to the work that you're doing.
I'm saying, what are you doing from a programming standpoint, right, that you're making it different, that you're shifting what you do to keep the kids excited?
Right.
Because if you're not, if you're doing the same programming year to year, even if you're just adding in new things, but it's basically the same parameters around your programming, mm-hmm, you know, I can say for most kids, within 2 months, 4 months, they're been there, done that, right, next. And so how do you keep them for 5 years, 6 years? You don't. So you've got to continually constantly push to evolve that product and what you're, and it is a product. Like, mm-hmm, it's your kids are the consumers of this product.
Right.
You know, and if you have to almost look at it from almost like the for-profit sector.
Yep.
You know. And
cool. We do have to wrap. We got just a couple minutes here. I just want to ask you two more questions.
Yeah.
I mean, I love that. I think it's accurate to say that you have a complicated relationship with being the mouthpiece and the face of this organization, because you just want to do the work. But I think the benefit of what you've done is that what I'm hearing is you've also built a team around you that are strong where you're weak, and it enables you guys to run in your different lanes so that you can meet the need. But I'm curious about the connection between, you know, the work that you do on your vehicles and with your boat, and there's like a grit to that, and the connection to the work that you do with these kids.
Yeah. I mean, something always needs fixing, right, at the end of the day. And that's something that I don't know, I thrive on that for some reason. I didn't even realize it until recently, you know, that I guess that's at a DNA level. I don't want the easy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I want the challenge.
Yeah.
And I want it, you know, I want to go in as deep as I can to find that challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And going back to, you know, I've found a staff that, first and foremost, they believe in the work.
Right.
They believe in the way we do the work, and they believe in me.
Yeah.
And it's amazing what you can do with competency. Not one of our guys, we talked about this last week with you know, there's basically five of us. Every one of us is a black sheep. Every one of us is you know, the oddball, first of all, because we got into bikes, and that was not the thing to do for most in high school. You were sort of the weirdo. But none of us, you know, none of us have this nonprofit background. None of us studied this. None of us, and it's such a clean slate of pragmatic, logical, intuitive, instinctual thinking that drives us, and we collaborate. You know, Matt Kuhn, Matt Crane, Wilson, Thomas, Sam Park, you know, we come together and these are some of the smartest guys that I know that we collaborate and we talk. And my board, Peter Frazier, Peter Henry, Carolyn Goble, just people that can just allow to think about this and not from a textbook.
Right.
And I think that that's what's been great with this organization, why we've been able to get as much done as we have in such a short amount of time is because we're not, it's amazing what people can do when they're allowed to think. Mm. And I think people are starved for that a lot nowadays. So,
yep. So final question, it's about Richmond. I mean, you've been here 10 years now ish, give or take.
Yeah. On and off. Yeah.
How have you seen Richmond change in the last 10 years? Where are you excited and what still needs to be addressed? Where are there still issues?
Look, I came here for a sole reason, but the reason I stayed here is probably the reason a lot of people are coming here or also choosing to stay here, which is I could feel right around 2007, you could feel this sort of renaissance. There was something happening. I love the juxtaposition that there is such a contemporary wave of activity happening within a very staunch history.
Hmm.
I think that's cool. I think when those two worlds collide, there's almost like the big bang that happens. And there's this authenticity that and cities like Charlotte, they don't have that.
Yeah.
You know, you just, I mean, come on, man, this is the capital of the Confederacy. And then look at what is also happening on all this progressive side.
Right.
I don't know where else in the country this is happening.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm sure there's somewhere, but it seems like all the progressive cities, they were always progressive. People talk about Boulder, they talk about Portland, they talk about Boise, they always seem to kind of be, I mean, progressive. You look at Richmond and really this has just started happening in the last 10 years, but really the last five.
Yep.
And it's been a tidal wave, right? So that's my take on that. It's in terms of where I see some gaps and, you know, I think that there are some fundamentals that need to be secured first before we can move too quickly towards this.
What are some of the fundamentals?
Like, well, you know, you got education, right? And people talk about that all the time. That's been a hot topic. There's a bit of debate going on right now, you know, between the bike race that came here, which I think was a great event. I believe with Holmberg that cool cities need to do cool things.
Yeah,
I believe that.
And you were out there with the kids. We talked to you guys.
That's yeah. Right. Yeah, we were out there. We were relevant to that. We were part of that. That felt great. The races ended on a Sunday. The next day on Monday, the HVAC system goes out at Armstrong High School. Okay.
Right.
So, and it was an issue that apparently had been known about for 5 years. I don't think it's an either or, and I believe in that. That's where the discussion is. You know, I don't think it's, you can have functioning schools and a good school system. You can either have that or you can have a great bike race. I think you should be able to have both, or not just a bike race, but events in general.
Right. Something that the bike race represents.
That's correct. Yeah. So this sort of vibrant culture. You can have, you should be able to have both. What I do think is that it's important for those events, especially on the large scale, that they do hinge themselves to a legacy, that there's something left behind, whether it's a reoccurring event that happens every year, or it's a one-time event. It's important that you make it, you should have both. So if you're going to do this event, you know, make sure that there's something left behind, especially for those who aren't really on sort of those rings,
like the inner circle, or even like one ring out.
Two rings out. I mean, you were at the bike race. There weren't a lot of, you know, weren't a lot of
kids from the neighborhood.
Kids from the hood out there. Yeah. We were pretty much it. And our kids even noticed that. You know, their exact comment was, "Craig, it's a sea of white people." Well, you know, they like bike racing. So, you know, there's got to be something that starts to suture the entire city together.
Cool. Yeah, I love the idea of we can have the both and, where we have the on the one hand, great restaurants, great events, a vibrant cultural capital, but also how do we address some of these other issues like education and poverty in the region? That would be remarkable. So, Craig Dodson, thank you for joining us. I appreciate hearing the two people behind your story of growing up, how you got into biking, hearing about your dad, just the grit and tenacity that you approach your work, and then how that comes to life publicly with the Richmond Cycle Corps. So best of luck to you guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's great.
This has been Two People.
Big thanks to Craig. For more information about the work that he does, you can look them up at richmondcyclingcorps.org. You can find our show via iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, where you can subscribe. You can also find us at twopeoplepodcast.com, T-W-O-P-P-L podcast. Our theme, as always, is by No BS Brass. Chris Payne is the Mr. Miyagi of the internet. I also want to mention our next episode is going to be a special on the bike race. We were out there recording. We will revisit some of the sounds of the race. We'll ask what it means for the city. And you'll also hear from this guy,
Herman Pruisken.
So be on the lookout for that. Thanks for listening.